This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo for Carol Castiel. On February 11, 2016, a group of excited scientists held a press conference here in Washington, D.C. What they had to say rocked the scientific community. Researchers with the LIGO Scientific Collaboration, a consortium of the California Institute of Technology and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, announced they observed gravitational waves for the first time. Gravitational waves are described as ripples or waves in the fabric of space-time, the interconnection of space and time. According to the scientists, gravitational waves are caused by some of the most violent and energetic processes in the universe. In this case, it was the violent collision and merger of two black holes some 1.3 billion light-years away. The announcement of the scientific breakthrough took place a little over 100 years after the brilliant Albert Einstein predicted their existence in his general theory of relativity. From that point until August 17th of this year, the scientists reported three additional detections of gravitational waves, all produced by the explosive merger of black holes. Not only did scientists make their fifth detection of gravitational waves on August 17th, but they also learned that the waves were produced by the collision and merger of two neutron stars, which are the smallest but most dense stars known to exist in the universe. This time around, along with detecting the gravitational waves, thousands of scientists, including today's guests, working at a number of facilities around the world, were actually able to observe in visible light the cosmic event that produced them. Since the science behind this breakthrough is so sophisticated and intense, I've invited my guests to help us get a better understanding of this discovery and why the science community considers it to be one of the most significant advancements in years. Joining me today are Anthony Pirro, a theoretical astrophysicist and a scholar at the Carnegie Observatories, Carnegie Institution for Science in Pasadena, California, and Benjamin Chappie. He's an astronomer and a professor at the University of Hawaii. Ben, first to you. There had been four detections of gravitational waves prior to the August 17th event. Why was this detection of gravitational waves so special in the scientific community?
All the previous ones have been the merger of black holes, and they're very exciting and interesting by themselves, but they're much more massive than what we saw here. What we saw here was actually two neutron stars merging. So if you merge two black holes, you expect to create another black hole, and there's very little expectation that you should see any signature other than gravity. You shouldn't see any light emitted. But if you merge two neutron stars, the expectation for a long time has been that you should be able to see those in other messengers, in other ways. So you should actually be able to look with optical telescopes and see that event after it merges. And then you should be able to learn more about the physics and what's going on of that merger by being able to study it in multiple ways.
Tony, could you give us lay people understanding what is a neutron star? How are they produced, and how common is it for two neutron stars to get attracted to each other enough to orbit each other and then collide?
So neutron stars are some of the most amazing stars you could ever imagine. So these are the dense cores of massive stars, much more than 10, 20 times the mass of our sun. When they die, they leave these cores. And a neutron star core, it's something like 1.5 times the mass of our sun, but the actual radius is only about 10 kilometers, so about the size of a city. And so you're just packing all this mass into this tiny compact object. And just to give you an idea of what kind of density do you have here, this is the same density. If you took one sugar cube of a neutron star, this would have the same mass as all the humans on Earth packed together. And this is the kind of extreme type of star you need to produce these gravitational waves. Getting to your other question about the neutron stars and these binaries. So we actually have eight of these neutron star binaries that we know about in our own galaxy. And we see these things slowly merging due to the emission of gravitational waves. But it's going to take hundreds of millions of years for these to merge, so we can't actually see these with our gravitational wave detectors. But we can actually look at neutron stars when they're getting even closer to each other, right in the moments when they actually merge in far-off galaxies like we did here. And a typical galaxy like the Milky Way, we think these happen every 50,000 years or so, which may sound like a long time, but in terms of astronomical times or length scales, that's actually pretty common.
This particular discovery was incredible. There were so many scientists, so many institutions involved with this discovery. Astronomical facilities around the world were involved in this discovery. Ben, could you give us a little bit of an outline of how extensive the science community was involved in this finding?
Absolutely. This was probably one of the biggest astronomical efforts on any single study yet undertaken. For the gravitational waves, you really only detect the source with LIGO and Virgo. So at that stage, they're the only players. And then less than 2 seconds after these two neutron stars that Tony just described merged, there was a strong gamma ray burst. Gamma rays are just the same as photons that you see with your eye, but they're much higher energy. They're so high energy they can't go through the atmosphere, so you have to go to space to detect them. Those were detected with the Fermi Space Telescope, also Integral, which is another space telescope. So now, less than 2 seconds after merger, we already have LIGO, Virgo, and two space telescopes. They got together and realized what was going on. They put out an alert to the community. And then basically anybody who studies transients, so changing objects on the sky, everybody was interested in this. So anybody who could try to look for this. Chile was the first place this part of the sky was visible. So there's a huge number of people who searched for the object right away. The group that Tony and I are involved with were the ones who discovered it first. But then after we alerted the community that we found a potential optical counterpart, basically anybody with a telescope on the ground tried to observe it. Swift Space Telescope immediately was also searching for it and also followed it up afterwards. It's a UV X-ray telescope. Chandra observed it. Hubble Space Telescope observed it. So basically, any telescope that could point at it pointed at it, including radio like VLA, which is a big radio telescope in New Mexico. If you've seen Contact, that's one of the telescopes there. So basically anything that could did look at this.
What I'm impressed with is the magnitude of involvement by the scientific community in this discovery. I mean, this logistically had to be a real difficult thing for everyone to put their resources together and join together to make this discovery. Tony, your thoughts about that?
Well, I think a part of it just speaks to the magnitude of the discovery, that everyone wanted to coordinate and work together like they did. I'm just taking Carnegie Observatories as an example. So we have a number of telescopes on the mountain range where we work. We have the two Magellan telescopes that Ben was mentioning, the 6.5 meters. We have the DuPont telescope, a 2-meter telescope, and the Swope telescope. And so even after we discovered the counterpart, over the following 3 weeks, we had to coordinate all sorts of efforts amongst the different telescopes, trying to find people that would help us follow it up, try to get different types of data so we could investigate this object as well as we could. But everyone knew, understood the magnitude of the discovery. And so we didn't get a lot of pushback when we were trying to involve more people and trying to coordinate things. It was really a testament to, you know, everyone working together and trying to get the most science done possible, which just made an incredibly exciting experience.
How do you know where to look in the sky to observe the event that caused these gravitational waves, Ben?
We've taken a step back just slightly. So a gravitational wave is basically the stretching of space by a very small amount. So these are huge detectors. They stretch a couple kilometers, a couple miles long, and they're looking for a change in distance that is much smaller than an atom, and even smaller than a proton, which is a part of an atom. And so it's very hard to do. And so the reason you need multiple detectors is to actually get information about where it's coming from. So one thing that you can do is, just like GPS works, there's a time delay, so light travels at a certain speed, so do gravitational waves. And which detector they hit first, you can get information about what direction they're coming from. Another thing that you can do is that just by the properties of these gravitational waves, they actually affect the distance in different directions slightly differently as they pass. And so then the multiple detectors can actually get some information on direction as well by how strong of a signature that they see in each arm of each detector.
These gravitational waves, they were predicted over 100 years ago by Albert Einstein in his general theory of relativity. I hear them being described as ripples in the fabric of space-time, and that sounds rather poetic, but what does that really mean?
It literally means that as these stars are merging, they're sending out ripples that you could imagine like ripples on the surface of a pond. But instead of being ripples of water, they're actually ripples in space-time, where length scales are actually getting longer and shorter as these ripples pass by. And if you had a clock, the clock would actually be going faster and slower. It's just incredible that you actually have these ripples in space-time themselves that are traveling by.
Tony, since you headed up the Carnegie team on this discovery, do you have any stories you can share with us as far as what it was like when you first took a peek in visible light at the event that caused this gravitational wave?
So when we first discovered it, it was just pretty incredible because we didn't know what it was going to look like. There had been a lot of theoretical expectations worked out in the past trying to understand what this would be, but it ended up being this bright blue source on the galaxy that just looked beautiful, like this blue diamond shining on this galaxy. And so it was just pretty breathtaking to know that we were the first people witnessing these photons coming from a gravitational wave source like this. Ben was actually on the mountain the night when it was discovered. What kind of excitement it was for him to be running around trying to find this elusive source in the sky.
Absolutely. So I was on the mountain at Las Campanas, and I had two nights on Magellan. And so for astronomers, time on a telescope is very precious. You have to apply for it, you know, months in advance, and you have to specify exactly what you want to observe, and you have a big plan. Everything has to be really carefully laid out. And actually, another side story is what's funny on that night is I was actually going to study Assassin 15LH, which is the most luminous supernova ever discovered, which I discussed with you last time I was on. So that's actually the object I was supposed to be observing that night. When I woke up, my email was just full of emails from a lot of collaborators basically saying that there was this detection. Like, you wake up in the afternoon, and then right then there was this, you know, this scramble. I have to figure out exactly what's going on and figure out what I can do to, you know, try to help this, you know, discovery. And then I realized that I was on one Magellan. Josh Simon, another Carnegie astronomer, was on the other Magellan telescope. And we also had SWOPE to search with as well. And so we had three really good telescopes to search for this event. And so we're in a perfect position to try to, you know, map out every galaxy where it could have been in very quickly. And so, you know, I skipped dinner. I contacted the director of the observatory to say, can I switch the programs? You know, what can we do? And basically, I was told that, you know, just throw his name around, get whatever I need to search for this object, do whatever it takes. And so at that point, we organized ourselves, and it was just this frantic rush of organizing exactly what you want to do. On that night, I actually had two graduate students with me and one undergraduate to basically learn how to use Magellan and how to observe. And so I just kept repeating myself to them on this frantic way of trying to organize the night. I said, basically, everything that you see here is not what you should be doing. Everything on a big telescope should be boring. It should never be exciting because you want to have, you know, just planned out ABC. And so a graduate student at UC Santa Cruz actually gave us a list of galaxies he wrote before this event happened, this computer program, to figure out exactly what was the most efficient way of tiling a particular part of the sky to get all of the galaxies. And so then just 15 minutes before nighttime, he gave us these lists of galaxies that were prioritized for each telescope. So on my telescope, we were searching in the infrared, so redder wavelengths than you can see. From SWOPE, we were searching basically in the optical, but really red light. And then from Josh Simon on the other Magellan was searching in blue. And so we started searching very frantically all of the galaxies. And just 15 minutes in, I get an email from Charlie Fitzpatrick, who was just basically flipping through the images that we were taking by eye. And he says, you know, very understated way, you know, I think I found something from SWOPE. And I thought in my head, I'm like, this is way too easy. This has been searched for you know, many years, and this is just about 15 minutes into the night, we already had a candidate. And I was just like, oh, this is way too easy. Something has to be wrong. I kept searching from my telescope, and then Josh sends an email really quickly afterwards saying, oh, I'm on the same galaxy on Magellan. I see the same source. It's real. So at that point, I was like, wow, this could be real. I moved to that target as well, got infrared data on that source. Josh immediately switched to get a spectrum, which is basically kind of like if you take a prism with light and you spread it out like that Pink Floyd album, you can see the different colors. And then that allows you to get different fingerprints from the spectrum. And then the source is setting, so it's basically becoming further and further near the horizon, and your telescope can only point so far over. And so it was this frantic rush to get as much data as we could right before the source set. And then I was able to switch instruments again and get another spectrum with a higher resolution so you could see finer detail. Right as the source, you know, hit the hard limits of the telescope, so where the telescope just can't go down any further. And so at that point, we just basically, you know, took a breath and said, well, you couldn't observe the source anymore. And we said, wow, this really happened? Is this really the source? And then we during all this, while all this time was happening, Ryan Foley at Santa Cruz was basically writing and basically a message to the entire community saying that we found something that's probably the counterpart to the gravitational wave source. And he put it out, and then we realized, you know, after the fact, after we, you know, had a couple of minutes to actually piece everything together, we realized that we were, you know, the first, you know, team to see it, the first to get data, the first to see it, the first to discover that it was the counterpart, and the first to announce it to the community and start follow-up data. And, you know, it was quite a surreal experience when we realized that we were, you know, so fortunate to be in a perfect position on all the telescopes during this event that people have been waiting for, you know, decades. It was quite great.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Here's a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. Connect with us by email at encounter@voanews.com or check out our Facebook page at Carol Castiel, VOA. Today, we're talking about the recent scientific discovery that includes the detection of Einstein-predicted gravitational waves and the first visual observation of the explosive neutron star merger event that produced them. My guests for today's program are Anthony Puro, a theoretical astrophysicist and a scholar at the Carnegie Observatory's Carnegie Institution for Science in Pasadena, California, and Benjamin Chappie, an astronomer and a professor at the University of Hawaii. Tony, this event with the two neutron stars crashing into each other and then merging has been called a kilonova. What is a kilonova?
So this term was actually penned by Ryan Metzger, who is now a professor at University of Columbia. And we were actually working together at the time when he first was working on this. And the basic idea was that as these neutron stars merge, they're going to fling out this very neutron-rich ejecta as they're ripping each other apart. And this ejecta is able to actually to synthesize different heavy elements as it's flying away from the merger site. And this stuff ends up being very radioactive and causes the ejecta to glow. And so typically when we talk about, like, transient new types of stars, we call these novae. There's different types. There's supernovae, which are the deaths of massive stars. There's kind of typical classical novae, which are much dimmer events that are also seen from different types of stars. And because this new type of transient that Brian had been working on was right in the middle of kind of the dimmer novae and the supernovae, and they're about 1,000 times brighter than the dimmer novae, he called them kilonovae, kind of like a kilometer or something like that, the same sort of nomenclature. So it's like a supernova, but maybe 100 times or so dimmer than a normal supernova. And that just has to do with how much radioactive waste you're actually flinging away from the merger site. And so the gravity of the neutron stars is very strong. Most of the material settles down into the merger remnant, but about 1/100 of the mass of our sun or so gets flung away. And it's this amount of material that then glows with its radioactivity that we see as this kilonova.
Tony, one of the other big stories that came out of this particular discovery, not only being able to see the source of a gravitational wave, was the fact that scientists now have a better understanding of where some of the heavier elements of the universe originated. Gold, platinum, uranium, I understand, were formed as a result of events such as the kilonova.
Yeah, so you've probably heard the phrase that we are star stuff, and this comes from this idea that's been around for decades now, since like basically the 1950s, that all of the elements that we see around us are synthesized in stars or synthesized in the explosions of these stars and supernovae, which then expel all these heavy elements back up into the galaxy, form new generations of stars, eventually planets and things like us. But there's always been one missing part to that story. And that was where about half of the heavy elements come from. These are called R-process elements. They're called R-process because you need this environment where you can rapidly put neutrons together to produce heavy elements. Because neutrons, of course, don't have charge. If you pack them together fast enough, you can make nice heavy elements. Things like you mentioned gold, platinum, uranium, a lot of expensive things, europium. And so it's always been a mystery, basically, for about 70 years. What are the environments where these R-process elements are actually generated? And people have suspected neutron star mergers for a long time, but there have also been other ideas. But with this event, with the actual glowing of the kilonova that you see, based on that brightness, you can measure how bright, how much R-process material was synthesized in the ejecta, and it actually ends up being just about the right amount to explain how much of all these elements, gold and platinum, there actually is in our universe.
Ben, from what I understand, we have had gravitational waves produced by the merger of black holes and now the merger of neutron stars. Are there any other cosmological events that could cause the production of gravitational waves?
Yes, the merger of the black holes that we have seen with LIGO and Virgo, they're tens of times the mass of the sun. And as far as black holes go, they're actually pretty small. There are other black holes called supermassive black holes at the center of our own Milky Way. We can actually see direct evidence for one of these supermassive black holes at the center of our own galaxy. We've seen other evidence that they exist in basically any Milky Way-sized galaxy we look at. And we know that these Milky Way-sized galaxies merge. So that means that two of these very massive, supermassive black holes have to be present in the same galaxy after galaxies merge. But we don't see very much evidence for two in any individual galaxies, a couple cases. So we know that these supermassive black holes must merge together at some point. There are future missions, like the LISA mission, that are actually designed specifically to study the merger of these supermassive black holes. So these are, you know, millions to tens of millions times the mass of our own sun. The reason that LIGO and Virgo can't see it is because they can only listen to a certain frequency of gravitational wave. They can't actually hear low enough frequencies to be able to study the supermassive black hole mergers. So that's why we need to have a new mission. And we have to go to space because you need much larger distances to measure these low frequencies. And you have to get away from noise sources such as on the Earth, the ground. Geology actually makes the whole ground rumble. So you have to go away from the Earth to actually be able to study these. These are a new and exciting future direction for gravitational wave research.
Ben, what have we learned from this discovery? If you were to encapsulate it, what would you say that was the biggest thing that we got out of this discovery?
Probably there's two big questions that were answered with this event. I think the first one is that for this decades long, we've been suspecting that this certain type of gamma ray burst comes from the merger of two neutron stars. And here we just see A and B. We see exactly what is expected. We see two neutron stars merging, and then we see the gamma ray burst. So I think that is just a completely solved question because of this discovery. I think the second part, Tony's been talking a decent amount as well, is that there's this, you know, long-standing question about where certain elements and isotopes come from on the periodic table. And now we've just seen two neutron stars merge, and then we see evidence for these isotopes, that have a slew of these isotopes. And so I think that connection is also probably one of the big major discoveries. But I think this discovery also left a bunch of questions open. So exactly how it looked like was different than theoretical expectations. And understanding why it looks a bit different will take years of effort, maybe even decades, studying this event and kind of combining all the data that was collected by many different groups and then carefully analyzing that and then building new models and refining those models to actually understand exactly what went on. I think these will be a legacy of this event as well. Just going forward, I think a lot of people, this will be an amazing data set to go and test against.
Tony, what did you take away from the discovery?
I think this really is the beginning of a new era. In the past, we've always been limited just using telescopes to learn about what's happening in the universe. And now we have these two completely different tools. We have the light that we've been using before, and we can now combine it with gravitational wave information. And together, we can learn about things that would never be possible with just one or the other. And so I just really think this is a really important moment in the history of science and how we're actually probing and learning about the universe.
Ben, Tony, thank you so much for joining us today and bringing us up to date and helping us get a better understanding of this magnificent scientific event.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Great pleasure.
That was Anthony Pirro, a theoretical astrophysicist and a scholar at the Carnegie Observatory's Carnegie Institution for Science in Pasadena, California, and Benjamin Shappi, an astronomer and a professor at the University of Hawaii. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. Thanks so much for listening. Encounter was produced at the VOA studios in Washington, D.C., and our broadcast technician was Thomas Blondet. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join Carol Castillo again next week for another encounter on The Voice of America.